WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl, abducted 4 weeks ago in Pakistan, was confirmed dead yesterday. A videotape given to Pakistani police depicted his murder. As American and Pakistani officials worked to bring his killers to justice, those who knew him mourn his death. This hour, remembering the life and work of Daniel Pearl. We begin with the latest from Pakistan on the continuing investigation. In response to Pearl's murder, Pakistan President Pervez Musharraf says he will liquidate the perpetrators. Susanna Price is a reporter with the BBC in Islamabad. I asked her what we know about Daniel Pearl's killers and their cause.
Well, this is the question that everybody's been asking right from the moment Mr. Pearl was kidnapped. It simply hasn't been clear who took him. It's been assumed there are Islamic militants, extremists. It's assumed that they are angry about, in particular, the American-led coalition and the war in Afghanistan. But beyond that, it's been very difficult to ascertain who they are. They sent email messages with a name, the Pakistan Movement for the Restoration of Sovereignty, that nobody had heard of before. Their demands were so wide and so vague and included better treatment of Al-Qaeda and Taliban suspects being held in Guantanamo Bay, the release of the former Taliban ambassador to Pakistan, that they knew those kind of demands would never be met. And then they cut off all contact for the next 3 weeks. The only thing we hear then is about the video. So it's not clear what prompted the killing of Mr. Pearl. It's not clear what they wanted, whether they had meant all along to kill him because he was American, or if they simply wanted publicity. No one has really got to the bottom of it yet.
There are four people being held. Who are they?
Well, the prime suspect is a British-born militant. His name is Omar Sheikh. He was named as the main suspect. He'd been involved in a kidnapping before in India in the 1990s and was imprisoned there for some years. When he was caught, it was thought that he could be the key to solving the whole issue and he would lead them to the kidnappers. He's been giving out contradictory statements about whether Mr. Pearl was alive or dead, and he hasn't helped the police find where he was. The other three who are being held are in connection with the two emails that were sent with pictures of Mr. Pearl with guns being pointed at his head and holding the day's papers. They are claiming that they were only involved in sending the emails. They were told by this prime suspect, Omar Sheikh, to go out and buy a camera and to send these emails, but they say they weren't involved in the kidnapping thing itself. The government has now said there are four other suspects. It has the names and the details of these four people. It's even detained some members of their families, and it believes that once it's got these four, it will have broken up the network.
Mr. Pearl was looking for a connection between Al-Qaeda and Richard Reed, the so-called shoe bomber who was arrested in the mid-Atlantic before he could blow up a plane. What do we know about that connection?
Well, he was trying to meet the leader of an Islamic militant group here, who it said Richard Reed also belonged to. Now, this Islamic leader has said that he is not a militant, that he has a website, he has many supporters in the United States, and Richard Reed may be one of them, but he's certainly not responsible for any acts of extremism. So it's thought that Mr. Pearl had been promised an interview with the leader of this group, and he may well have walked into a trap, that there was no intention of setting up a meeting with this leader. So that was the story he was working on. There are undoubtedly people feel here, Al-Qaeda sympathizers and people like that in Karachi.
The New York Times says that this undated video cassette shows Mr. Pearl being stabbed. Is that what you're hearing, too?
Well, we haven't heard anything officially on how he was actually killed. What we've heard from the authorities is the video shows him being murdered. What we had heard was that it actually shows him having his throat cut, that he is talking and then his throat is cut. But I haven't spoken personally to anyone who's actually seen this video. We've heard it is gruesome. It's a very upsetting video. And we haven't had any official confirmation of the details.
Did you know Mr. Pearl?
No, I didn't meet him. He was based in Bombay for a while before, and then he came over to Pakistan after September the 11th. But I know a lot of journalists who did meet him here, and they've all spoken about him with great respect. His humaneness, his kindness, and his real interest, not in getting the superficial story or the spectacular story, but people say he really wanted to understand what made these people tick. And I think it's that fact, that curiosity and that wanting to bring the story out actually seems to have been the cause of his death.
He is either the 10th or 11th journalist killed in the theater. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. We had most of them killed in Afghanistan itself.
Yeah.
During the fighting.
And we've had one American soldier killed by enemy fire. So you journalists really sort of constitute the front lines in this war. What is that like, being a potential target?
Well, I think it kind of goes in waves. After September the 11th, foreigners and particularly journalists felt very vulnerable here in Pakistan. A lot of people evacuated. Then the situation calmed down. Then we had these big demonstrations and very anti-Western. Again, it calmed down. And I think it's really, people generally feel quite safe here in Pakistan. Although foreigners have been kidnapped here before, there's never been this kind of political kidnapping.
Finally, have Pakistani officials been working closely with U.S. Officials out there in trying to find him? Has that worked well? I know in Saudi Arabia, in investigating some of the terrorist actions there against American servicemen, the Saudis were not helpful.
There has been very close cooperation, and in fact, both countries have been at pains to point this up. FBI agents have been over. They've been helping out, especially with the more technical aspects, such as tracing where these emailed photographs came from. After this video was sent, the State Department spokesman said that both countries would continue working together to bring those who carried out the murder to justice. Pakistan's President, General Musharraf, spoke to President Bush on the phone during the afternoon and expressed his deepest sympathy. So I think what you're finding is that far from America blaming Pakistan for this killing, what they're saying is that Pakistan is doing very well. It's trying to combat extremism. And this is really a very good illustration of the huge challenge that Pakistan faces in trying to root out these militants and hardliners.
Was there some resentment of the Indian government's reaction to this? I saw an Indian spokeswoman saying, well, this is Pakistan after all.
Well, yes. Towards the beginning of the case, there was a lot of talk. Even the foreign minister said that they blamed India for being behind this kidnapping. That idea has kind of gone away. And in fact, the interior minister today said they wouldn't comment because there was no particular proof. But I think it's always something there. Those two countries will always blame each other. It's not resentment. It's just a lasting problem.
Susanna Price is a reporter with the BBC in Islamabad. The delivery of a video cassette detailing the brutal murder of Daniel Pearl ended 4 weeks of torment for his family, friends, and colleagues. A statement issued by the Wall Street Journal called the killing an act of barbarism. His family released a statement saying, "We were confident that Danny would return safely, for we believe no human being would be capable of harming such a gentle soul." In a war where journalists have been on the front lines from the beginning, it remains unclear why Daniel Pearl was targeted. Known among colleagues as a cautious reporter, he died in the line of duty, pursuing a story about the connection between shoe bomber Richard Reed and Islamic extremists. Has the Daniel Pearl story touched you? Has it made you think better of the much-abused media? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now is Robert Zelnick, acting chair of the journalism department at Boston University. He was Pentagon correspondent for ABC News from 1986 to 1994. Welcome, Robert Zelnick.
Good to be with you, Jack.
What are you telling your journalism students about Daniel Pearl and the challenge of his work?
I tell them that I, in fact, teach a course on foreign reporting, and that they should know, and this brings it dramatically home that it can be a very challenging, very dangerous business, and that stories have to be pursued and the truth has to be obtained. But you also have to keep in mind safety where possible. And if a story is optional, if the risks seem to outweigh the benefit to humanity of learning the information, be a little bit cautious. But at the end of the day, if they want to be reporters, and if they want to cover wars, and if they want to cover unstable situations, which are often the most dramatic mm-hmm. and interesting stories, then there is a degree of risk that in many cases is greater than the degree of risk that soldiers assume. After all, mm-hmm. soldier goes out into the field today, a U.S. soldier, he can call in airstrikes. They can scan the area in advance. He can usually his weapons can outperform the weapons of the other side in terms of distance. If he is hit, you have a medic on hand more often than not. You can be medevaced by helicopter. Many of the journalists that have died covering combat over the years died from wounds that wouldn't necessarily be fatal, but they weren't able to get treatment very quickly, and that's part of the nature of the risk.
Of course, they're not soldiers. They work for competitive businesses. To what degree does that, the competition for a story, drive risk-taking? I'm thinking of the case of Arthur Kent. Maybe you could tell us about it. But basically, he was an NBC reporter who, according to what we've read, refused to go to Bosnia because he thought it was too dangerous and was fired for that.
Well, I think if you had 1,000 reporters, you'd have 1,000 different answers to that question. Mm. They're in a competitive business. But I think it's more than the competition. It is the kind of human being that chooses this as a profession in the first place. I mean, I was a practicing lawyer in the mid-60s and didn't feel I was getting a close enough view of history, and I bought a round-trip ticket to Vietnam and started freelancing. And there are thousands, tens of thousands of similar stories. The journalists, and I don't want to put us up on a pedestal. We have plenty of faults. But the journalist has this insatiable curiosity about events and human beings and movements and dramatic happenings and happenings that reveal the human condition. And more often than not, he or she is going to go down that road the extra mile, even if there's risk involved.
How do you assess the risks that Daniel Pearl was taking?
I would say they're at the high end of the spectrum. I would rather have negotiated my way down a mined road with a suitable guide, of course, than try to do an investigative report on an Islamic militant movement and try to link it to the or see if it could be linked to the shoe bomber, Richard Reid. He's really the first journalist to die in the Afghanistan theater pursuing what would have to be described as an optional story. You're not out covering the war. You're not out covering the reaction of the Afghan people to the expulsion of the Taliban. You're doing an investigative report by a Bombay-based reporter trying to link the latest terrorism suspect to radical movements in Pakistan. And at the same time, and I don't want to get too far into it because I only know what I read in the papers about the nature of the assignment, but at the same time enlist the cooperation of the leader of the movement in this. And that is that's high rolling by my definition.
What was his crucial mistake?
I don't want to call it a mistake.
All right, we'll talk about the risk he ran coming up. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beattie. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about the life and death of Daniel Pearl today, with Robert Zelnick, acting director of the journalism department at Boston University. He was ABC News Pentagon correspondent from 1986 to 1994. Just before the break, what I was trying to raise was the question, essentially, of what goes through a reporter's mind when he finds himself in the position of Daniel Pearl, who was to have met, according to the stories we have, his source at a public restaurant, and suddenly he was called, the venue was changed. Give us the calculus there that goes through, and have you been in situations like that?
Well, first of all, again, I don't want to characterize any decision that he made as a mistake.
No, I apologize for that.
I tried to say that it was at the high end of the risk spectrum, and I believe that. By the time they changed the venue, if Pearl was the same kind of reporter I think he was, and if he was like many other great reporters and journalists I know, he was so anxious to get that interview, to get that story, to advance the knowledge that he probably wasn't thinking public-private. He was thinking, this guy's going to see me, and he's going to respond to questions.
Yes.
And then I'll be able to inform the Wall Street Journal readers, and that was what was touching him. I think when I look back at some of the decisions that I made, and again, I was based in Israel before I covered the Pentagon. I was there during 84 to 86. That was a period when the Israelis still had their hooks deep into Lebanon, and there were a lot of instances where they would close off villages and interrogate the people looking for Amal guerrillas or Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. And there was one instance at the a southern village called Marrakech where the Israelis apparently planted a bomb in a mosque where a number of militants were meeting. The bomb went off. 12 militants were killed. And we wanted to get up there and see what the village was like and see what surrounding villages were like under the Israeli rule. And the Israelis wouldn't take us. They said, no, you know, this is not a story we're anxious to propagate. So we made contact with the UN observer group that was in southern Lebanon and asked them to put us in touch with the Shiites. Now, this was at a time when many American journalists, Terry Anderson and others, were being kidnapped and held by the Lebanese. And we weren't 100% sure the kind of welcome we'd receive. And we weren't 100% sure that our hosts would even be able to control what happened to us. But the UN took us to a drugstore in the town of Tyre in southern Lebanon. A Shiite cab driver picked us up with our camera gear and everything, and drove us around to three or four different villages, including Marrakech, which is only about 3 or 4 days after the bomb. And you can imagine the mental and emotional state of the village. And here were four people. My producer, Mark Nelson, was with me, Westerners, and they asked us where we were based. And I told them, let's not lie, because they may know where we're based. And I said, we're based in Tel Aviv. And we did the story, and I was very glad when it was finished. I was very glad when we got in the car and drove back through the cab, drove back through southern Lebanon and got home.
That was one anxious ride.
I've several times been with troops that have come under fire. But that's kind of the nature of the beast.
Right.
This was a special kind of optional danger that we took.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us now on the line is Kevin Cullen, reporter with the Boston Globe, and he reported on the Balkans for 4 years, and before that from Northern Ireland for many years. Welcome, Kevin.
Hi, Jack.
Kevin, you knew Daniel Pearl. Tell us about him. Are the TV anchors describing your colleague accurately?
Yeah, I mean, I overlap with Danny a bit in London and then saw him again on a number of occasions when he moved to Paris. He was based in Paris, and I used to see him in France on occasion. Yeah, everything you hear about him, I think, is accurate because he was very low-key, but very funny and a very just a nice guy. If you talk to anybody who met him overseas, I think they'll all say that because a lot of us tend to be big egos, all that stuff. Dan Pearl was really liked by most people who met him. I just found him to be a really nice guy and a very good reporter. His stuff, he had a great eye for detail, could really write about nuance and those long stories in the journal that you read from beginning to end. And he was one of their best. He really was. So everything that everyone has said about him journalistically, believe me, it's accurate.
You've had to run risks like such as the ones he was running in Northern Ireland and elsewhere. What goes through your mind? Essentially the same question I was asking, excuse me, Bob Zelnick. I beg your pardon.
As Bob said, and I'm glad he did say it, I think it's hard to characterize what Danny did as a mistake. He was a cautious guy. He was not a cowboy. There are cowboys in the foreign correspondent business, and we know them all, and I saw them particularly in the Balkans, people who were taking risks that were just, I thought, really extreme. Danny was not that type of guy.
How would you define an extreme risk?
An extreme risk is, I remember on one occasion in Kosovo before the NATO troops got in, me and a couple other American reporters had come down from Belgrade, and there was a question of going up a mined road. And I thought about it and deferred to a colleague, Tom Hunley from the Chicago Tribune, who said, we're not going up that road. Whatever story's up there, it's not worth it. And I was a moron over there. I had never really I had done Northern Ireland, which was dangerous at one level, but not anything like the Balkans or the Middle East. And I really often deferred to my colleagues who had a lot more experience. Tom Hunley is a classic example. He had worked in the Balkans for 10 years before I worked with him. And I just deferred to him. He was a guy with a lot of experience. And, Danny went, obviously, the change of venue at the last minute, that does not strike me as odd, especially in that world. Karachi is a very, very big city. And so the change of venue didn't mean necessary. The other thing is I'm sure Danny believed that those people would have seen the journal as such an important news organization that it really was in their interest to get their message out. And I'm sure that would have informed his decision to go there and meet somebody alone, which is risky. I don't care where you do it. But, you know, frankly, if you get a call from a dodgy person in Dorchester and say they want to meet you at a park late at night, that's a dodgy thing to do. So what happened to Danny? Frankly, the people that did this, they were capable of killing him on the street any time. Yes. They were capable of coming into the room he was staying in Karachi and killing him right there or abducting him. So I really don't think what he did was any more risky than being in Karachi itself.
Yeah. We have a caller who met Daniel Pearl. Nick, hello. Welcome.
Hello?
Yes. Hello, Nick.
How you doing?
Well, we're fine.
I guess ever since the news came over this afternoon, I've been kind of thinking about what way I would like try to remember Danny Pearl, who I only met for a couple of days and was not at all connected to any kind of journalistic endeavor.
Where did you meet him?
In Iceland, I met him a few years ago when I was there visiting family, and I was at a festival during their bank holiday, and it was all Icelanders, all young people on this volcanic island. And I remember just walking around, just kind of like taking it all in, feeling like kind of an outsider. And I remember the wind blowing and just catching this music. And I remember looking over to this cave, and I see these two Americans. And I was so I'm like, oh, we're going to go check it out. And I went over there, and I just met these two guys. It was him and his friend from San Francisco, and they kind of didn't really want to talk about what they did professionally, like when I asked them, because I guess they were probably just on vacation. But they were playing, they were playing violins, mandolins, guitars for all these Icelandic kids who were just, they would just sit there and call out these songs. They would say, you know, play Metallica, you know, mm-hmm. and there they are sitting there with their acoustic instruments, and they would just work it out, and they played, and the kids, they just loved it. And just ended up, like, walking around and taking it all in just as another American. And as the story turned out, someone ripped off his mandolin when we were there. And so I remember bumping into him, just seeing this, like, you know, terrified look on his face, like, someone stole my instrument. So we just all scoured this festival, and I ended up finding it and kind of stealing it back. And got it back for him, and then over the next day, it starts raining. No one can get off this island because we all flew in, and it's just miserable. And we're sitting there in this tiny airport, and they were like, "Well, we're gonna try to get a boat off of here because we can't stay here anymore." And they ended up finding this like tourist boat, and they bought my ticket off the island. You know, he said, "Well, you got my instrument back. I'm definitely, you know, I'm gonna get you out of here." Mm. And they bought my ticket off. And after that, I think I was the next year, sent me a Christmas card, you know, and it mm-hmm. said, you know, thanks for saving my musical life. Mm. And this was just like, you know, someone I knew for like a day. And I almost really just couldn't believe it when I heard his name again, like the first time the reports came over the news.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that memory with us. Let's take another call from Jay in Providence, Rhode Island. Hello.
Good evening, Jack, and good evening to your guest. I often wonder what happened to Bob Zelnick. Now I know what he's doing now. I used to follow his report all the time from Pentagon. Jack, I have a question. You know, there was a Pakistani reporter that had been interviewed in the past few weeks, Hamid Mir, was his name. He said that he told Mr. Pearl not to go see these people by himself. And I wonder if you heard anything about that. And my second question to Mrs. Zelnick is this. Do reporters often come up with the idea themselves, or they given the assignment from the editor, which one they can follow?
I don't know anything about the Pakistani reporter telling Daniel Pearl he shouldn't go alone. I don't know anything about that story.
Yeah, this was on BBC.
Reporters, particularly foreign correspondents, have a way of trying to push stories because they often come across information that their editors back in New York or Washington know nothing about. At the same time, it's a two-way street because the editors are saying, well, we need somebody to in Kandahar or cover the advance of the Northern Alliance. So many of the mandatory stories are assigned from the home desk, whereas the enterprising reporter, and I'm sure in this case Pearl probably had a lot to do with defining this assignment, they try to interest and sell stories to New York.
How about you, Kevin Cullen? Does this editors putting pressure on reporters?
Well, I mean, somebody like Danny, the pressure would have been himself. He was a driven reporter. So, and in terms of the decisions, just the sheer time difference, a guy like Danny in a position like that, he would have been doing most of it on his own because he would have put in 8-9 hour a day before his editor even got to the desk. So, generally, when you're on a foreign assignment like that, I frankly don't know if this was assigned, if somebody suggested, why don't you try to find these guys? But in terms of the logistics and being on the ground, he really was on his own. There wasn't much that people in New York could really help him with on that.
Mm. We have on the line Ann Cooper now. She's executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Welcome, Ann Cooper.
Thank you very much.
And NPR and WBUR listeners will remember you for your long service with NPR. You covered Russia. Where else?
I was the Moscow bureau chief for NPR for 5 years and then South Africa bureau chief for 3 years in the first half of the 1990s.
Mm. You know, Ann Cooper, in Somalia, U.S. soldiers reportedly tried to pass themselves off as journalists. Has your organization seen more of this sort of thing? And what does that do to real journalists?
I don't know of cases of U.S. soldiers passing themselves off in that way. That may have happened in Somalia, but I don't know about it. We have seen a couple of cases over the last year or year and a half. One was actually in Luxembourg. One was in the U.S. where police were impersonating journalists in hostage situations so that they could carry a camera into, you know, they promised someone who was holding hostages, we're going to interview you for local TV. You will get the publicity that you want. And they would actually be police carrying in the camera and then, you know, arrested the hostage taker. And we have opposed that very strongly. We fear that anything that, you know, starts to confuse who is a journalist or, you know, if somebody says they're a journalist, you know, as a hostage taker or someone going to think, aha, no, they're actually the police or the FBI or whatever, that is something that potentially threatens all journalists.
Mm. What can be done to protect journalists abroad? Does the government have a role there? We've just said that we don't want the government involved in one way, but could they be involved in another?
Well, they could be diplomatically, sure, and, you know, certainly have been in any number of cases where journalists have been, for example, arrested by a foreign government and often accused of spying. And, you know, these things tend to become large international incidents where diplomatic pressure can be very important, you know, just as well as just general pressure from the international community that this kind of behavior is not acceptable.
And finally, what is your organization saying about this?
About Danny Pearl's death?
Mm.
Well, like everyone else, we're stunned and horrified. This appears to be nothing but an act of barbarism. You remember the first statements that came out from Danny's captors referred to political goals. That seems to have been completely bogus.
Mm.
It appears that he was entrapped. I don't know what was in their minds, what purpose they had. It's a senseless and baffling murder and horrifying for every journalist, certainly every foreign correspondent and all of their editors.
What effect do you think it's going to have on the practice of foreign correspondents?
I think that's very hard to say at this point. You know, we talked with many journalists today, and everyone, of course, is soul-searching about this and thinking about what can we do. I've spoken with editors who've said, what do I do about my correspondents who are now in the Philippines, a place where, you know, the group Abu Sayyaf has made no bones about taking hostages, including journalists.
Mm.
You know, these are important stories that need to be covered. You don't want to send your reporters there and have them sit in a hotel room.
Ann Cooper, thank you. Thank you for joining us. Ann
sure.
Cooper is the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Kevin Cullen, Bob Zelnick, stay with us. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about the life and death of Daniel Pearl. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Join us, please. Kevin Cullen, what do you say when people run journalism down, when you hear these facile disparagements of the media? At a moment like this, what do you want to say to people who say that sort of thing?
Well, the media, describing the media as a giant monolith, I think you know as well as I know, Jack, it's just not accurate. I mean, when people say that if they criticize radio as being a bastion for hate mongers, that they're certainly not talking about NPR because of the quality program or the BBC. And, you know, I was talking to somebody else today because I was out chasing another story today. And this is about as depressed as I've been on the job that I can recall, and it's not just because I knew Dan Pearl, because he wasn't a friend of mine. We were friendly, but I mean, it's just really depressing, and I also don't think that this is the end of it. I think that this kind of sets a new benchmark, and I think there will be other abductions of not just American journalists, but Western journalists in general. And it's a very depressing thing, but I think also that, it sounds like a cliche, but, Danny made the ultimate sacrifice, and it's a noble profession when it's practiced by people of the caliber of Dan Pearl.
Mm. Robert Zelnick, what do you want to say when you hear that kind of thing today? Journalism?
I hope that people, the journalism is not always reflected by the Danny Pearls, and it's not always reflected by the people that cut corners, and it's a profession as varied as the people in it. I think when you get to the more illustrious newspapers like the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Wall Street Journal, and many others that we can mention, you're dealing with very, very dedicated and committed people, and people that are serving in their own way, serving humanity and serving the very values of this country. I just wanted to add one other thing. When I was at ABC, we buried two of our journalists who were murdered in action. I was the news director in Washington for just a very short while when one of our New York-based reporters, Bill Stewart, was covering the uprising against the Somoza government in Nicaragua. And he was just cruising in a car with his fixer and a television crew when they came to a routine government checkpoint. They made him get out, lie on his stomach, and one of the guards just shot him in the back of the head, and it was captured on camera and played many times on ABC. Also, Dave Kaplan, who was a very well-known producer, was Sam Donaldson's producer, and they went over to Bosnia, landed at Sarajevo on the drive-in. A sniper fired one shot into the vehicle that they were driving in and killed David. He died an hour or so later. Fortunately, neither of these two deaths established a precedent. As far as I know, the Somoza people did not kill any other Western journalists. The Bosnians, who apparently were the snipers in this case, did not, to the best of my knowledge, target Western journalists in the future. I think the condemnation of the world, the conveying the notion that these people are gaining nothing by it, that they are earning only the contempt and enmity of humanity, is perhaps something of a check on this, although, in this day and age when people are flying planes into buildings and killing thousands at a time, it's hard to know what strikes a responsive chord.
Yes.
But maybe something will.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ash is on the line. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you. I just wanted to take this opportunity to strongly condemn this act. And, I mean, to me it seems, I don't know what sort of people it would be who would carry out such a barbaric and in some ways, I don't know, medieval sort of crime and be sadistic enough to, and gruesome enough to record it and send it to people. And the other thing I wanted to say was it probably sends out a very important message that despite what we are thinking, terrorism is probably not even down and not even out. If they can do such an act with, no concern, and especially at a time when the president of Pakistan was making a trip to the U.S.
I'm glad you used the word terrorism, because this act is continuous, isn't it, with the act of September 11th?
It is. It is. And, I mean, this has to be, stopped one way or the other. Otherwise, it's just going to become like a downward spiral with things flaring up all over the place.
I think the government, the Bush administration, we talked about this on the show, has adopted a new policy of essentially the National Security Council is now going to review hostage cases and figure out ways to intervene. And basically they're trying to say, if you kidnap an American citizen, the U.S. government is after you. Do you think that will have a deterrent effect?
I doubt that it will have a deterrent effect, although I encourage the administration to strike back when American citizens are put at risk or harmed or abducted or murdered. I think that we have to keep our eye on the long-term battle and recognize that even if it's won, it doesn't write the final chapter to individual acts of terrorism. The only real goal that the Bush administration has, and I suspect the Clinton administration had and the next administration will have, will be to make it tougher for these people to operate in concert, to commit international crimes, where people in Afghanistan are pulling the strings for people in Boston or New York City or Washington, D.C., and to win what is essentially a war of attrition.
Kevin Cullen, how about you? Do you think the government can deter some of this, or world opinion, perhaps?
I'm sorry, Jack. In what context?
Well, we were talking about the Bush policy of now the government is going to take review every hostage taking abroad, and they're going to be involved in them at one level or another. Do you think that would act to help or expose U.S. journalists?
Well, it could actually encourage. I would think it would encourage more hostage taking if, in fact, that the goal of the hostage takers is to get attention. If, in fact, the president is going to go on and talk about it, that would seem to suit their purpose. So it's sort of like when terrorists were hijacking planes a lot in the 70s. They did it because they got attention, and they were on TV live often in Europe when they were doing these things. And I think there were decisions made not to to give them the oxygen of publicity. And in that respect, and with good law enforcement work, those number of hijackings decreased dramatically. So it's certainly murky waters. It's hard to say, but my gut tells me that you would be encouraging the type of people who killed Danny.
Yeah. Let's take a call from Mike in Warwick, Rhode Island. Mike, I'm sorry to have to hurry you along, but you've got a story to tell.
Yeah, I'm pleased to see all this attention of, you know, finally on somebody who's been kidnapped like this, although I never thought of that. It might encourage more. I was a reporter in Russia from 91 to 94, and I got kidnapped at gunpoint and driven in the woods and almost killed once, which didn't really have anything to do with me being a reporter. I think it was just getting in the car with the wrong people. But then pretty near before I left, I got ambushed at my apartment by four guys, and that, you know, that could have been pretty much anybody. I had criticized, you know, the mafia people and the communist conservative parliament and even Yeltsin. So, you know, you really don't know what's going on there. I mean, Russia is the most dangerous place in the world, or the former Soviet Union. There have been about 60 reporters killed. I did a big story on Media Channel about all the situation there, because Putin has completely cracked down on the press there. And I mean, there's even stories of the leader of Ukraine having some reporter killed who was criticizing him. And the two people, the two oligarchs that were criticizing Putin, you know, basically been driven out of the country and you know, their entire assets taken over.
Right.
There's pretty much no free press left.
To what do you think you owed your life?
Well, you know, the second time I got away from them somehow. I think one of them didn't want to do it, and he split off from the other three, and you know, and they said, come on, what are you doing? And I, you know, ran into the apartment building and ran up to four and jumped in the elevator, which happened to be there, and took it to eight and sent it down to six then. And then as I was in my apartment, I could hear them on the landing, you know, like chatting. And, you know, I was like, oh, boy, you know, maybe it's time to move. You know, the thing was, if they didn't know where you lived, you were relatively safe. But at that point, I had registered because I was, you know, official journalist there and actually a foreign correspondent. And so, you know, a lot of people knew I lived in Russia. It was so corrupt, even the government people would sell addresses of people, you know, to the mafia people to go get robbed or killed or something. It was a pretty chilling place. You never knew where things were coming from.
Mike, you've chilled us. I expect that made you want to become a lawyer. Thanks very much for the call. And thank you to my guest, Robert Zelnick. He's a professor of journalism at Boston University, and Kevin Cullen, reporter for the Boston Globe. Thank you both. Daniel Pearl's work took him around the world, from the hills of western Massachusetts to the deserts of Iran, and finally to Islamabad. Here, journalists from WBUR read excerpts of Pearl's writings from the pages of the Wall Street Journal.
October 17th, 1994, Los Angeles. David Marquette still doesn't know if he left the borrowed Stradivarius on the roof of his car and drove off, or if it was stolen from the unlocked vehicle while he bought groceries. That was in August 1967. Mr. Margetz, then a second violinist with a string quartet at the University of California at Los Angeles, sent notices to pawn shops and violin stores and took out classified ads. He spent the next 27 years worrying that the Duke of Alcantara Stradivarius, made in 1732, was gone forever. It wasn't. Officials of UCLA,
June 30th, 1997, Ben, Iran. This is a small town in search of a really big floor. It should be a bare floor, big enough to accommodate about 6,000 people, with no columns breaking up the space. And it should be crying out for the subtle, decorative touch of the world's largest hand-woven carpet with a third of an acre of beige, brown, and blue swirls and flowers. Working in two shifts in a converted fire station at the top of a hill, 84 women have spent 2 years on the carpet so far, and it's only half finished. The asking
May 14th, 1996. Could be as Doha, Qatar. American blues can make you sad. Russian work songs can make you suffer. The fervent belief of many in the Persian Gulf is that pearl diving songs can make you go blind. The songs are undergoing a revival, a half century after crowded pearl boats plied the shallow Gulf waters for the last time. As a new generation in the Gulf rediscovers the wailing old spirituals, they are rediscovering the special pain of singing them. Sometimes I feel like my head is going to
explode. December 31st, 1999, Trepka, Yugoslavia. When the blanket-covered trucks rolled towards the mining complex near this northern Kosovo town in April, Beksad Krti didn't give them much thought. The Yugoslav army had a military base there, after all. It was in July, after the fighting ended, that Mr. Krti returned to battle-scarred Trepka, that the young house painter started hearing the whispers. "Did you hear there are 700 bodies in the mine?" asked one acquaintance in the hilltop cafe above the mineshaft tower. "No, not in the mine, but in the furnace on the other side of the mountain," said another. By late summer...
November 16th, 2001. Mererani, Tanzania. In the shadow of Mount Kilimanjaro, miners with flashlights tied to their heads crawl hundreds of feet beneath the East African plain, searching for a purple-brown crystal that will turn into a blue gem called tanzanite. Many of the rare stones chipped off by the spacemen, as the miners are called, find their way to display cases at Zales, QVC, or Tiffany. But it's a long way from these dusty plains to U.S. jewelry stores, and the stones pass through many hands in their journey. Some of those hands, it is increasingly clear, belong to active supporters of Osama bin Laden.
Journalists from WBUR reading from the work of Daniel Pearl. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarti, Nate Dimeo, Eileen Yamada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michelle Stearns, Tim Skoge, and Laura Tanguso. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.